Good evening. On behalf of Wolfson College, the Foundation for Law, Justice, and Society, and the University of Oxford Center for Sociolegal Studies, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's lecture given by Professor Dennis Galligan. And this lecture is part of the Foundation for Law, Justice, and Society's new program on law, film, and literature. And I should explain that the structure of tonight's lecture is a little unusual. It's much more like a performance. So Professor Galligan will speak for about 30 minutes on the upper register before we get to have a break, an interval, to refresh yourself before we return and plunge down to the lower register. Professor Galligan will be assisted by Dr. Francesca Galligan, who will recite the passages from Shakespeare. And Dr. Francesca Galligan trained in classics and medieval literature at Wadham College and is curator of rare books at the Bodleian Library. Professor Dennis Galligan is a fellow of Wolfson College and professor of sociolegal studies at the University of Oxford, and he's published extensively on a variety of aspects concerning law and society, including seminal texts on discretionary powers and administrative justice. His current research focuses on the social foundations of constitutional and administrative law, and tonight he will be speaking on Shakespeare and the lower register of constitutional thought.
Thank you, Erica, for this nice introduction. And I want to thank my daughter, Francesca, for agreeing under, I wouldn't say too much coercion, but maybe just an element of persuasion, to take part in tonight's performance. She will recite the Shakespeare parts, as Erica said. I shall just give the lines in between. So Shakespeare and the lower register of constitutional thought. First of all, the setting. David Hume, the Scottish philosopher, historian, writing in the late 18th century, observes that, and I quote, "Anyone of a philosophical mind will wonder at the ease with which the many are governed by the few, and the implicit submission with which men resign their own sentiments to those of their rulers." It is all the more curious, Hume went on to note, when you consider that power, raw power, is always on the side of the governed. For, as he writes, governors have nothing to sustain them but opinion. How then is that raw power of the people tamed? How is opinion guided towards acquiescence? To this question of law and society, of the social foundations of constitutions, I've been engaged for some time, and I think I've found some answers. This lecture is an adjunct to the larger project, the point of reference here being selected plays of William Shakespeare. Well, much has happened constitutionally since the 18th century, but the same troubling thought that preoccupied Hume might enter a curious mind today. The texts of contemporary constitutions reveal a language, a set of concepts, and a range of practices that, taken together, make up a distinct mode of thought. It is based on three main concepts, each of great antiquity in constitutional history: sovereignty, representation, and consent. The people are sovereign, or if not sovereign, at least the source of sovereignty. They elect representatives who govern in the name of the people, who are assumed to consent to whatever actions their representatives take. Constitutional texts express these ideas, this mode of thought, which is said to be the culmination of centuries of struggle, out of which emerges a victorious people in charge of their own affairs. We the people, the opening words of many constitutional texts, is a confident assertion of sovereignty and self-government. On closer study, however, things are not so straightforward. The Constitution is the people's constitution, but the people are curiously absent from it. They have no constitutional role in the conduct of their affairs. They are governed by representatives and officials over whom their control is severely limited. This mode of thought, this upper register of constitutional thought, as I shall call it, at first sight appears to be the people's register. On closer scrutiny, it turns out to have the effect of keeping the people out of the Constitution. their constitutional role begins and ends in casting an occasional vote for a small sector of government, leaving representatives and officials to get on with governing. The great democratic narrative of a self-governing people emerging triumphant has at its heart a large whole. If the sovereignty, self-governing narrative is uncoupled from social reality, then what sustains modern constitutional orders? This is intriguing because we are dealing with stable and well-working orders, orders that deliver effective government in which the people acquiesce. Acquiescence is Hume's answer. According to Hume, the people acquiesce in, or tacitly accept, effective government. This is compelling sociologically and definitely an improvement on the medieval doctrine that the people were bound to obey unless and until the ruler reached an intolerable level of tyranny. But Hume's answer is still empty of content. We want to know under what conditions the people acquiesce or withdraw acquiescence. It cannot be fear, for the fuse of fear is short and hardly a foundation for a lasting constitution. Wholehearted consent is implausible, for who among the people would not cast a cold eye on much of what is done in their name? Somewhere between the inferno of fear and the paradiso of consent, somewhere in the purgatorio, we might unearth the elements of acquiescence and the secrets of constitutional success. In place of the view from above, from the perspective of ruling elites and their ideas about constitutions, I want to examine the view from below, the perspective of the people, the ordinary people, common people, their ideas, language, and practices. I do so in confidence of discovering a different constitutional universe, one steeped in experience, and being so steeped, both socially authentic and essential to constitutional understanding, whether today or 500 years ago. This I shall call the lower register of constitutional thought. So there you have it. You now know what the title of my lecture means. Evidence for a lower register, which by nature is likely to be hidden, unheralded, and unrecorded, is found in unlikely places, in the moral economy of the crowd, a concept invented by E.P. Thompson, in the forms of passive resistance in conditions of oppression and confinement, such as feudalism, serfdom, and slavery, the weapons of the weak, an evocative term coined by James Scott, an anthropologist, and most strikingly in rebellion, Wat Tyler, Jack Cade, and the Levellers, for instance. To these already abundant resources, I wish to add another, less obvious, but immensely rich. I refer to the plays of William Shakespeare. I cannot, of course, do justice to the full range of plays, but by focusing on a few, I hope to show enough to prove my case. My claim is that running through the plays is an understanding of the nature of authority, of the fragility of constitutional order, and the innate and stubborn social divisions that can never be removed, at best only blunted. Enough to make Shakespeare a constitutional theorist and a socio-legal scholar of the first order, even if among his ample ambitions to be such was not his first or even his last. So let us look now at the view from the upper register. We now think of constitutions as written texts stating the rules of government. This is a modern idea. Constitution historically meant something different. One spoke of the body politic and the constitution, its state of health and well-being. In the 1640s, parliamentarians and others, including the Levellers, were agreed that after years of personal rule, the body politic was in poor constitution and needed to be restored to good health. John of Salisbury, centuries before, may have been one of the first to use this imagery in accounting for the English constitution. The nation is in good constitution, says John, if all the parts are in their place and working well. Each sector has its place, God the soul, the prince the brain, tax collectors, of course, the belly, and so on. The people, naturally, the feet. The body politic and the organic constitution are familiar features of Shakespeare's plays. Towering above all is Ulysses' speech in Troilus and Cressida. Things are not going well for the Greeks. The generals gather to take stock. Agamemnon begins the debate asking, "Princes, what grief hath set the jaundice on your cheeks?" After listing the misfortunes the invaders have suffered at the hands of Hector, he urges courage, which steels Nestor to resolve to confront fortune. Ulysses intervenes and begs attention. "It is not fortune," he argues, "or the strength of Hector's sword that is to blame, but Greece itself, where
the specialty of rule hath been neglected. And look, how many Grecian tents do stand hollow upon this plain."
He continues,
"Degree being visored, the unworthiest shows us fairly in the mask. The heavens themselves, the planets, and this centre observe degree, priority and place, in fixture, course, proportion, form, office and custom, all in line of order."
Then the glorious planet Sol is enthroned and sphered. Bodily metaphor makes its entry, for Sol's medicinable eye corrects the ill aspects of planet's evil.
"But when the planets, in evil mixture to disorder wander, what plagues and what portents, what mutiny, what raging of the sea, shaking of earth, commotion in the winds, frights, changes, horrors, divert and crack, rend and deracinate the unity and married calm of states quite from their fixture."
That unity and married calm is the cement of civil society. All depends on degree. How could communities, commerce, and peace survive without degree? How could there be authority, crowns, scepter, and laurels, except by degree stand in authentic place? Take degree away, and the ensuing evils are terrible to behold.
"Oh, when degree is shaked, which is the ladder to all high designs, the enterprise is sick. Take but degree away, untune that string, and hark what discord follows. Each thing meets in mere repugnancy. Strength should be lord of imbecility, and the rude son should strike his father dead. Force should be right, or rather right and wrong, between whose endless jar justice resides, should lose their names, and so should justice too. Then everything includes itself in power, power into will into appetite, an universal wolf, so doubly seconded with will and power, must make perforce an universal prey, and last eat up himself. Great Agamemnon, this chaos, when degree is suffocate, follows the choking."
When all are in their place, all is well. Order is maintained, and the body politic is in good constitution. Untune that string, and order is destroyed, and with it civilized life. The people's place is far from affairs of state. The king, with council of elders, rules. The people obey. Thomas Smith, a great public figure of the 16th century, wrote, "The common people have no voice or authority in our commonwealth, and no account is made of them, but only to be ruled." The relationship between head and feet is one of command and obedience. Obedience is passive. It neither allows nor requires active engagement of the people in ruling, or the scrutiny of rulers. That sentiment was widely shared, taken for granted, central to the upper register of constitutional thought. In Henry VI, Part I, called the first part of the contention, the Duke of York wastes no words. "Let them obey who know not how to rule, and the common people know not how to rule." how are we to make sense of this relationship? It is surely incomplete, lacking social foundations. For remember Hume's warning that power finally lies with the people. For John of Salisbury, an early Humean realist, the feet are not for governing, have no place near the head, yet being essential to the organic whole, they must be looked after. For if the feet stop working, the body has to crawl, wrote John, shamelessly, uselessly, and offensively on its hands, or else is moved with the assistance of brute animals. Unquote. The duty of the rich and powerful is to, quote, put shoes on its workers. For John says nothing is more ignominious than a barefoot republic, a memorable phrase. Is John warning only of the danger of brute power, of rebellious feet? Or is there a hint of more, of the people being more than bearers of the body politic? Is it just a matter of keeping the feet well booted, paternalistic benevolence that keeps the people in line? Or is there need for something more? John of Salisbury diagnosed the illness, but not the full cure. Before considering what that cure might be, we need to see how the upper register of constitutional thought copes with the people. The organic constitution imposes its conventions and constraints. In Henry VI, Part 2, Lord Salisbury, referring critically to Buckingham and Somerset, states,
"While these do labour for their own preferment, behoves it us to labour for the realm."
Those who rule must labour for the realm. Then of the hated Cardinal Beaufort,
"Oft have I seen the haughty cardinal, more like a soldier than a man of the church, as stout and proud as he were lord of all, swear like a ruffian, and demean himself, unlike the ruler of a commonwealth."
There are standards expected of a ruler. By contrast to the cardinal, Warwick, Salisbury's son,
"Thy deeds, thy plainness, and thy housekeeping hath won thee greatest favour of the commons."
The people have to obey. But it's not just a matter of blind obedience, after all. Obedience has to be earned. Of York, Salisbury's brother, who subdued the Irish and has now returned from the war in France, his exploits
"have made thee feared and honoured of the people."
Honour joins fear. Rule must be for the realm, the commonwealth, the public good, the common profit of the land, the common weal. All familiar phrases. It must be for the good of all. When it is, the people will honour their rulers as well as obey. Since it is hard to associate honour with feet, a quite different relationship emerges between rulers and ruled. Reciprocity is the essence. If the rulers rule well, they gain the honour of the ruled. But why does reciprocity matter? It matters because it gives obedience a social foundation. Rulers who win the people's honour, who rule well, are likely to be obeyed, and the body politic preserved in good constitution. Sustaining the bond, earning honour, between rulers and ruled is not easy. Other realities intrude. The people are integral to the body politic, but they are at the same time a threat to it, for they can destroy it. The body politic of good constitution, with all its parts in harmony, is an invention, a metaphor, a mode of thought whose purpose is to sublimate a harsh reality where the few have much and the many little, where the glaring inequalities, the injustices and the oppression would otherwise be a bleeding wound fatal to the body politic. By translation into a universe of ideas, the bleeding is staunched. It is, however, a universe uncoupled from social reality. And so the body politic is frail, and the threat ever present of collapse back into harsh reality. The brutish reality vividly described by Thomas Hobbes, for whom nothing was more imperative than to avoid such relapse. Uneasily, rulers ride the dilemma. The people must be included in the body politic, but they are contemptible, incompetent, uneducated, and at worst, they are the mob. The respect required of reciprocity is easy prey to cruder instincts. The mildest of those is condescension. In A Midsummer Night's Dream, the Duke, about to celebrate his marriage, asks, what mask, what music is planned? Aegeus, the noble courtier, replies, a play there is, some 10 lines long. The play, he says, is both tedious and hilarious, for the players are
hard-handed men that work in Athens here, which never laboured in their minds till now, and now have toiled with unbreathed memories with this same play against your nuptial.
Never laboured in their minds before. They're ignorant, uneducated mechanicals. Aegeus advises against, but Theseus, the Duke, the honoured ruler, insists on the play.
For never anything can be amiss when simpleness and duty tender it.
The mechanicals, carpenter, weaver, tinker tailor, and bellows mender, are said to be rough and inferior. But the Duke knows his duty as ruler, knows how to earn honour. Lysander, his betrothed, following Aegeus, complains that the mechanicals are not up to it, can do nothing of this kind, she says, that is, put on a play. The Duke is firm.
The kind are we to give them thanks for nothing. Our sport shall be to take what they mistake and what poor duty cannot do. Noble takes it in might, not merit.
The kind are we, noble respect. These are virtues expected of a good ruler. They require benevolence and paternalism, not just command. But the majesty of rule is above and aloof. Even great clerks become tongue-tied in the Duke's presence and dumbly break off, not paying me a welcome. Yet?
Out of this silence yet I picked a welcome, and in the modesty of fearful duty I read as much as from the rattling tongue of saucy and audacious eloquence.
What matters is that subjects show a fearful duty, even if the means of expression is modest. Fear and honour, remember, go together. To the fate of the wedding mask we shall return. Condescension is only just short of, easily slips into, contempt. The Tempest opens with the storm raging. Prospero has been up to his tricks, and the boatmen are struggling to cope. The nobles, including the King of Naples and the usurping Duke of Milan, appear on deck and get in the way. They start to interfere. In such peril, conventional social relations come under strain. The boatswain pleads,
"You mar our labour. Keep your cabins. You do assist the storm."
Gonzalo, a noble of Naples,
"Good, yet remember whom thou hast aboard.
Know your place and show respect." But invoking conventional superiority is in vain in the face of nature. The great leveller, conventions lose their meaning. The boatswain asks whether Gonzalo, a man used to exercising authority, can command the elements to silence. "Use your authority," he urges. But of course, authority is a social convention of no use here. Here the mariners are masters. Their skills afford the only chance of survival. The boatswain grasps the situation. Gonzalo does not. If he cannot command the elements, then the boatswain has reason to order him to get out of the way. For Gonzalo, trapped in that upper register, unable to see it has been rendered obsolete by reality, the line of respect is crossed. From the honest old counsellor flows an outburst of invective as venomous as it is unmerited. The boatswain, according to Gonzalo,
hath no drowning mark upon him. His complexion is perfect gallows.
He was born to be hanged, not drowned. So they're all safe, but
if he were not born to be hanged, our case is miserable.
All this for doing his job. Worse is to come. The boatswain returns. Seeing Gonzalo still on deck, in sharpened tones, he asks,
"Yet again, what do you hear? Shall we give Owen drown? Have you a mind to sink?"
Sebastian, the brother of the King of Naples, intervenes in measured tones.
"A pox your throat, you bawling, blasphemous, incharitable dog."
The boatswain reasonably suggests,
"Work you, then."
The usurping Duke Antonio takes his turn to charm.
"Hang, cur, hang, you whoreson, insolent noisemaker."
The fault is plainly the mariner's. Antonio continues.
We are merely cheated of our lives by drunkards.
Undeterred by there not being a scrap of evidence of such. He prays that...
This wide-chopped rascal, would thou mightst lie drowning the washing of ten tides.
The washing of ten tides. For Gonzalo, drowning is too good for him.
He'll be hanged yet, though every drop of water swear against it, and gape at wides to glut him.
No trace of conventional constraint remains. The veneer of organic order and mutual respect is thrown off. The bedrock of division exposed, social relations are reduced to a red-clawed state of nature. The spiral is downwards, from condescension to contempt, contempt to hatred, whose intensity in Caius Martius, otherwise known as Coriolanus, reaches new heights. Given the title Coriolanus for his bravery in defeating the Volsci, Caius Martius is selected by the Senate for consulship. Now, to be appointed, he has to win acclamation of the people, which, by convention, they will give, provided he follows certain processes, appears before the people, bears his war wounds, and asks for their support. Coriolanus, a proud man, has trouble subjecting himself in this way to the gaze of the people. The reason, according to an officer on duty observing the scene...
That's a brave fellow, but he's vengeance proud and loves not the common people.
Not to love the common people is not to respect the bond of reciprocity and a bar to appointment. Friction mounts between the people and their tribunes on the one hand and Coriolanus and the other senators on the other hand. Relations among them are complex and subtle and would take too long to explain now, except to say that between Coriolanus and the people, relations are shaped and soured by the tribunes, without whose malignant duplicity Coriolanus would have been acclaimed. The immediate issue of Coriolanus's appointment gives way to a deeper debate about authority and government, about relations between the Senate, the wise and natural rulers, and the people, the bearers of raw power. The people are integral to the body politic of Rome, one sign of which is their role in appointing consuls. Yet they are also the mob. As tension rises, they slide in Coriolanus's mind and speech from being the people, whose voice is the legitimate vox populi, to become the mob. But for senators to give in to raw power is to
debase the nature of our seats and make the rabble call our cares fears, which will in time break ope the locks of the Senate and bring in the crows to peck the eagles.
Giving in to the people, the crows, would be to debase the elevated dignity of the Senate, the eagles. The tribunes tell him to stop, shut up. He persists. But now the veil of constitutional constraint is torn away. The image of an organic body politic shattered, social relations exposed in all their rawness. Left is no ground to share, no common language to invoke. The parties stand apart, the gulf between them unbridgeable. The people now are definitely the mob, the ignorant, many-headed monster, a common phrase, the many-headed monster, the bearers of brute force. The patricians disdain with cause the plebs, while the plebs, for their part, according to Coriolanus,
insult without all reason, where gentry, title, wisdom cannot conclude but by the yea and no of general ignorance.
Notice the contrast between the patriarchs, the wise, titled gentry, and the ignorant plebs. The consequence of giving in to the plebs...
A body with a dangerous physic that's sure of death.
The body politic would be doomed. The only remedy...
At once pluck out the multitudinous tongue. Let them not lick the sweet which is their poison.
The people are now the tongue, which becomes a malignant organ, fit only to be plucked out if the body politic is to regain health, be restored to good constitution. This is too much for the tribunes, who call on the people to gather and pass judgment on Coriolanus. In the meantime, in the name of the people, Sicinius, one of the tribunes, attacks Coriolanus as...
a traitorous innovator, a foe to the public weal.
To call on the public weal is to play the trump card. For guarding and advancing the common weal is the source of authority and its purpose. The roles are reversed. Coriolanus is now the threat to the common weal. Menenius, a respected patrician, tries to mediate, likening Coriolanus to...
a limb that has but a disease, mortal to cut it off. To cure it, easy.
The body metaphor is always at hand. Good health can be restored without amputating the diseased limb. The tempo quickens. Volumnia, his mother, pleads with Coriolanus to make peace with the people, whatever it takes. Say whatever is needed, regardless of what he believes, however much it goes against his nature.
With such words that are but roasted in your tongue, I would dissemble with my nature, where my fortune and my friends at stake required I should do so in honour.
Do whatever is necessary, even if you have to dissemble. A fine word, dissemble. But it's too late. The tribunes are out for revenge and charge Coriolanus with attempting tyranny. The people are stirred up, and despite a last plea of Menenius, Coriolanus resigns himself to death or exile.
I would not buy their mercy at the price of one fair word.
His parting curse, uttered part in anger, part belief, surpasses all that went before.
You common cry of curs, whose breath I hate as reek of the rotten fens, whose loves I prize as the dead carcasses of unburied men that do corrupt my air, I banish you.
Even in Republican Rome, where the common people had a place in the constitution and a voice in government, such enmity is thinly veiled, the disdain of the patricians barely contained. We see how this thin gruel of constitutional ideas and how frail the body politic fed on it. The mighty edifice of constitutional thought and the commonwealth it houses depend on the power of those ideas for containing conflict and promoting social harmony. And yet they work. This is the mystery. Government is effective. The people acquiesce. The body politic flourishes. The view from the upper register provides some explanation, but plainly not enough. For the upper register, the mode of thought it embodies, under strain, cracks and falls apart. The rest of the answer, the main part, has to be found elsewhere. But we need now to investigate the view from below, how the common people experience and make sense of authority, why they acquiesce in it. In that endeavour, William Shakespeare will be called in aid. That other register of thought, from the ground up, although not so obvious, on shallow digging, is there to discover. Before turning to the discovery, there is one final, terrible scene of revelation, of insight into the reality of rule and the nature of authority. The tragedy of King Lear. The roots of authority, of constitutional order, are revealed in all their starkness. King Lear is on the moor, mad, crowned with weeds and flowers. He comes across the blinded Gloucester and his son, the legitimate one, that is, Edgar. Gloucester recognizes Lear's voice and kneels. Thinking Gloucester is asking pardon, Lear is...
every inch a king. When I do stare, we see the subject quake.
He then proceeds to dismantle the very order kingship is ordained to sustain. Is adultery Gloucester's cause, he asks. If it is, he shall not die for it, for...
the wren goes to it, and the small gilded fly does lecher in my sight. Let copulation thrive.
Put aside artifice and restore a state of nature. May not be so bad after all. He stops himself.
Good apothecary, sweeten my imagination.
He asks Gloucester to read something Lear puts in his hand. Gloucester replies,
were all the letters sons I would not see.
Lear realizes Gloucester has no eyes, yet...
you see how this world goes.
Gloucester.
I see it feelingly.
But, replies Lear, you don't need eyes to see how this world goes.
Look with thine ears. See how yon justice rails upon yon simple thief. Hark in thine ear. Change places. And handy-dandy, which is the justice, which is the thief? Thou hast seen a farmer's dog bark at a beggar.
Handy-dandy, which is the justice, which the thief? Gloucester nods. Lear goes on.
And the creature run from the cur. There thou mightst behold the great image of authority. A dog's obeyed in office. Thou rascal beadle, hold thy bloody hand. The usurper hangs the cozener. Through tattered clothes great vices do appear. Robes and furred gowns hide all. Plate sin with gold, and the strong lance of justice hurtles, breaks. Arm it in rags, a pygmy's straw does pierce it. None does offend, none, I say none. I'll able him. Take that from me, my friend, who have the power to seal the accuser's lips. Get thee glass eyes, and like a scurvy politician, seem to see the things thou dost not.
The upper register has the robes and furred gowns, the plating of gold, to hide the harshness of the real world of injustice and oppression. But Lear has seen through it. In a more natural world, none does offend, none, I say, none, and he will seal the accuser's lips. Edgar gets the message.
Oh, matter and impertinency mixed, reason in madness.
From reason to revelation, from revelation to resignation. Lear.
When we are born, we cry that we are come to this great stage of fools.
This great stage of fools. It is a stage, an escape from social reality. Lear's madness is the madness that comes from deep revelation. That is all a stage, but a stage we cannot leave, for that is the way it is. And the only way to cope is resignation, stoic acceptance of what is the mystery of things. That's the first act. So there's a 10-minute break now before Act Two.
What's your name?
Laurel.
sorry, just wondering. Would you like a copy? Not, it's not for citation. Oh, just, it's not.
I may have to walk out a bit before the end.
It's working up to a climax, Nick.
Yes, I know, it's rather sad. Going to the theatre, in fact. So, I've got a bit of issue of timing.
Thanks for coming. I wonder if we could take your seats for Act Two, please. Would you mind just shutting the door there? Would you mind shutting the door, please? Thank you, thank you. Well refreshed, we will now tackle Act Two, the view from below, the lower register of constitutional thought. We've seen through the upper register, its offspring, the organic constitution. We've seen how it sits unsteadily on social reality and under strain crumbles. But we're no closer to knowing how or why the constitutional order, our own version of the organic constitution, admired far and wide, works. A fine and coherent system of constitutional ideas is plainly present, but socially ungrounded. When we look for social foundations, they are not there. Sovereignty, representation, and consent lack a footing in social relations. We find at the upper level a covering of civility, below which hatred, fueled by fear, simmers. And we've seen what little it takes for fear to boil over into hatred and tear apart the cover. And yet, a mystery, the people acquiesce. The sovereign power inherent in the majority, as Edmund Burke described it, is curbed and contained in accordance with the Constitution and rule of the few. How to square the two? Where to be found are the missing pieces of the constitutional jigsaw? The obvious place to look is to the people themselves, to excavate the view from below. What are the Peter Quinces, the Nick Bottoms, and the Tom Snouts, the commons, the untutored, the mechanicals, thinking? How do they perceive, experience, and make sense of the social order and constitutional conventions sustained by it? Will this lead to an account of constitutional thought that is truly grounded in social relations rather than planted on top? Perhaps we shall be able to answer Hume's question, why the people hand over so readily their natural power to the few. Well, here we enter the lower register of constitutional thought. Perhaps there's no more to it. No lower register, no constitutional world for the people to inhabit. That there is no such thing is ingrained and resilient. The commoners, as we saw, are there to be ruled and to obey their rulers. It's not obedience in Aristotle's sense, where citizens obey because they've been taught how to rule. And knowing how to rule, obedience is deliberate and purposive. This is not for the mechanicals. Theirs is supposed to be blind obedience, born of ignorance and fed on deference. They are to dwell, according to Duke Theseus, remember, in the modesty of fearful duty. Around the modesty of fearful duty, Karl Marx and Antonio Gramsci have thrown a suffocating cloak of explanation. According to them, the people are incapable of imagining a world different from that they inhabit. Worse, alienated from their true selves, they embrace that world as if it were the natural order of things, the coarse cloth of necessity becomes the mantle of a just and natural order. Alienation and false consciousness have their place, but why should we think the people incapable of imagining an order different from that they inhabit? Shakespeare knew better. At first, a hint. The love affair of Nick Bottom with the fairy queen, Titania, is all a dream. But if a weaver turned into an ass can mate with a queen, a fairy queen, anything is imaginable. Things could be different. Peter Quince has no trouble imagining a world where he would not be hanged for offending a lady. The conventional world hangs heavily, but that it hangs suggests it descends from above and rests uneasily on a deeper foundation. The mechanicals of A Midsummer Night's Dream give us a glimpse of that deeper foundation. These men, dismissed by the Duchess for never having, remember, laboured with their minds, are able to conceive, write, and perform a play, Pyramus and Thisbe. They might not be schooled in Ovid, but they know something of the classics. That Nick Bottom and Peter Quince can debate whether the meter be 8 and 6 or 8 and 8 shows they are literate. Their polished performance, that they are no strangers to the theatre. That Tom Snout should warn the audience of gentlewomen that he is not a real lion, and he will not roar too loudly, shows a concern not to frighten or offend their sensibilities. Far from being illiterate, uncouth, and unthoughtful, the mechanicals are schooled, respectful, and morally astute. The contrast with the young aristocrats is striking. While the mechanicals are working on the play, working out the meter, the aristocrats have nothing on their mind but flirtation, and nothing to do but frolic, infatuated, and fall under the spell of playful fairies. When the play within the play begins, the contrast deepens. The audience of the newly married Duke and his entourage is striking for the inanity of its remarks, ignorance of the world of the mechanicals, and its prejudice towards them. Peter Quince steps forward to deliver the prologue. It is fluent, nicely framed, subtle in matter, at worst a bit rushed. Lysander, the new bride, can only carp.
He hath rid his prologue like a rough colt. He knows not the stop.
She goes on.
He hath played on this prologue like a child on a recorder, a sound but not in government.
Playing music well and governing are thrown together, notice. The child cannot play the recorder, the common man cannot govern. The Duke agrees.
His speech was like a tangled chain, nothing impaired, but all disordered.
Disorder, the opposite of government. But the Duke, remember, is a grand man in whose presence he reflects.
Great clerks have purposed to greet me with premeditated welcomes, where I've seen them shiver and look pale, make periods in the midst of sentences, throttle their practised accent in their fears, and in conclusion dumbly have broke off.
But that is not the case with the mechanicals. They might not be at ease who among actors are, but they perform a play with aplomb before the upper crust of Athens. The Duke is ever gracious.
No epilogue, I pray you, for your play needs no excuse. Never excuse, for when the players are all dead, there need none to be blamed. It would have been a fine tragedy, and so it is truly, and very notably discharged.
What are the mechanicals thinking? How are they making sense of the occasion? They are calm and full of purpose, to entertain and honour the Duke and his party on his marriage. They know they must be careful. The roaring of the lion is worrying. Bottom boasts he's a good roarer. Peter Quince, the author of the play, a thoughtful man, urges caution.
And you should do it too terribly. You would fright the Duchess and the ladies, that they would shriek, and that were enough to hang us all.
The others agree.
That would hang us, every mother's son.
Bottom, ever the pragmatist, agrees to
aggravate my voice, so that I shall roar you as gently as any sucking dove.
Peter Quince is not convinced. Bottom had better play Pyramus instead.
For Pyramus is a sweet-faced man, a proper man, as one shall see in a summer's day, a most lovely, gentlemanlike man.
The mechanicals are respected and resigned to their place. But is there a ray of resentment showing through? How can it be that a man is hanged for roaring too loudly and frightening the ladies? Why should the common people labour under such a threat? How do the mechanicals make sense of this world? In the tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, the prince, being of the upper register by birth, but now having placed himself outside it, makes plain what the mechanicals dare not speak. You all know the lines.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and, by opposing, end them.
That's the bit you all know, but let us read on. Why live on, Hamlet asks, when
to die, to sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub.
There's the rub. We do not know what lies beyond. For if we did,
who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the strong man's contumely, the pangs of disprized love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of the unworthy takes, when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin?
But is that all? Is
the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns?
Is that enough to explain acquiescence of the people? Surely there's more to be discovered about their mentalité. One way to find out is to study rebellion. It takes rebellion to reveal what is normally concealed. It shows under what conditions respect and resignation give way to resistance, rebellion and revolt, all signifying that something has gone wrong in the body politic, so that normal acquiescence is revoked or suspended. Between quiet resistance and outright revolution, there are many shades of dissension, all evidence of sickness in the body politic. The appearance, when all is quiet, of unity, of the organic wholeness of the body politic, in the face of rebellion shows cracks and strains. From one point of view, rebellion is pathology, aberration, a departure from, even threat to, the constitutional order. From another point of view, it is the call for restoration of a more fundamental constitutional order, one that has social authenticity, is grounded in the realities of social relations, is able to accommodate, make sense of, the natural power of the people rather than suppress it. It is the fundamental constitution obscured and left behind when the upper register of constitutional thought and practice uncouples itself to cultivate a life of its own. Rebellion is common in Shakespeare. but none for our purposes better than that of old Jack Cade, who in 1456 led the Commons of Kent to Blackheath and demanded parley with the king, together with Wat Tyler, who led the peasants to revolt 69 years before. Jack Cade occupies a privileged place in the pantheon of villains. Charles I was not alone in holding them up as masters in demagoguery and proof of what happens when the people are incited to become the mob. If Jack Cade's reputation as a murderous maniac needs gilding, Shakespeare does the job. He is depicted as a man who, apart from an appetite for butchery, regards writing as such a lamentable thing that anyone caught in the act be summarily dispatched as villain and traitor. Scholars, lawyers, courtiers and gentlemen are false caterpillars to be killed on sight. Grammar schools corrupt the youth of the realm, and speaking French, of course, is treason. Jack Cade's ambition is to be the mouth of Parliament, and all will worship him as their lord. The list could go on, and Jack Cade of Henry VI, Part II, would struggle to win our vote. Yet, as is Shakespeare's habit, behind the character is a cause which, clouded by the queerness of character, is often missed. In the cause we hear the voice of the commons. The rebels enter. First rebel.
I tell thee, Jack Cade the clothier means to dress up the commonwealth and turn it and set a new nap upon it.
Second rebel gives the reason.
So he had need, for 'tis threadbare. Well, I say, it was never merry world in England since gentlemen came upon it.
Rebels and clowns unite, for remember the gravedigger in Hamlet.
Come, my spade, there is no ancient gentleman but gardeners, ditchers, and gravemakers. They hold up Adam's profession.
What have gentlemen done to make it threadbare? First rebel has the answer.
Oh, miserable age! Virtue is not regarded in handicraftsmen.
Lack of virtue breeds lack of respect. Second rebel.
The nobility think scorn to go in leather aprons.
Gentlemen do not labour, and the honest labour of working men counts for nothing. First rebel.
Nay more, the king's council are no good workmen.
The gentlemen cannot even rule well. The second rebel goes a step further.
True, and it is said, labour in thy vocation, which is as much as to say, let the magistrates be labouring men, and therefore should we be magistrates.
Roles could be reversed. We honest working men could govern. But use of the subjunctive mood, let the magistrates be labouring men, shows it is a passing thought. The commoners know they will never govern. The forces will always be against them. What is more pressing and possible is to insist on good government. Good government is the benchmark, the standard of acquiescence. Leaving the rebels for a moment, let us join the ambitious Richard in the tragedy of King Richard III. A group of citizens, on hearing the news of King Edward's death and the prospect of his young son becoming king, discuss the situation. Third citizen.
Woe to the land that's governed by a child.
Second citizen.
In him there is no hope of government, which in his nonage counsel under him, and in his full and ripened years himself, no doubt shall then, and till then, govern well.
The third citizen is pessimistic. When Henry VI was a child,
this land was famously enriched with politic, grave counsel. Then the king had virtuous uncles to protect his grace.
Now things will be different, for the child king is surrounded by danger and lacks the politic grave counsel. The Duke of Gloucester, the future Richard III, full of reckless, ruthless ambition, is hovering about.
Oh, full of danger is the Duke of Gloucester and the Queen's brothers, haught and proud. And were they to be ruled and not to rule, this sickly land might solace as before.
It is not the king who is to blame for bad government. It is the counsellors, the evil counsellors, who give bad counsel and lead the king astray. Those brothers haught and proud will serve not the common good, the common weal, but their own weal. They are instruments of poor and corrupt government. Back to the rebels in Henry VI. Why is the Commonwealth, the means to the common weal, threadbare? In what way is it badly governed? Cade's answer is to the point.
I tell you that Lord Say hath gelded the Commonwealth and made it an eunuch.
That sums it up. Government should be for the profit of the land, but Lord Say has used it for his own profit. Other grievances are aired. Earlier, a group of petitioners approached Gloucester, the Lord Protector. Petitioning was one of the avenues, one of the few avenues, for the commons to put their grievances before king or protector. What are their grievances? One complains of the cardinal's man,
for keeping my house and lands and wife from me.
Another, a poor petitioner who speaks for his township against Lord Suffolk,
for enclosing the commons at Melford.
A common complaint. A third goes further,
against my master, Thomas Horner, for saying that the Duke of York was rightful heir to the throne.
Luck is not with them. The petitioners are mistaken and approach not Gloucester, the Lord Protector, but Lord Suffolk, Gloucester's enemy, and Queen Margaret, Suffolk's lover, are present. The petitioners are treated with contempt by Suffolk, brutality by Margaret, who tears up the petitions in a tantrum and dismisses the petitioners as base scullions. In another scene, the Lord Protector is accused of violating the law in punishing offenders, in levying taxes to pay the soldiers in France, then keeping the money himself, for the sale of offices and towns in France. Suffolk is accused by the seamen before they murder him for swallowing the treasures of the realm, for growing great and wealthy by devilish policy, for selling Anjou and Maine to the French. At its core is the common weal, the good and benefit of all. All share the realm in common. King and common weal go together. The king's authority derives from and is directed at the common weal. Set apart from the common weal, kingship dissolves to nothing. In Henry VI, the king declares,
I shall be well content if any choice tends to God's glory and my country's weal.
All is done in the name of king and common weal. It is a formula to be recited. On finding the Duchess of Gloucester involved in an occasion of witchcraft, York declares,
the king and common weal are deeply indebted for this piece of pains.
Cardinal Beaufort, in accusing his enemy Gloucester of ambition for the crown,
pernicious protector, dangerous peer, that smoothed it so with the king and common weal.
Confronting his disgraced wife, Gloucester, knowing his turn is next, declares,
Madam, for myself to heaven I do appeal, how I have loved my king and common weal.
There is no place for adornment or deception here, no place for leers, robes, and furred gowns, no sins to plate with gold. All must be judged by the common weal. The king, the sovereign authority, finally decides what is best for the common weal. That is the concept of kingship. He must take counsel, but having done so, the king decides. In King John, the king invites a delegation of nobles to ask,
what you would have reformed that is not well, and you shall hear how willingly I will both hear and grant you your requests.
Pembroke asks for the liberty of Arthur, whom the king, his uncle, has detained. Pembroke makes the case and ends with an appeal to the common weal.
Let it be our suit that you have bid us ask his liberty, which for our goods we do not further ask than whereupon our weal, on you depending, counts it your weal to have his liberty.
The king reigns, not rules, a subtle but vital difference. For reigning suggests kingship as impersonal authority for the common good. While ruling involves personal authority as opposed to impersonal authority. Between king and commons there is a bond, an elemental mutuality. It constitutes the bedrock of the realm. The commons need a king to preserve and advance the common realm. The common weal is common to all. The king has no weal separate from that of the realm. The king, for his part, like the consul Coriolanus, needs the commons for his authority. They may be written off as a rude multitude, stern, untutored churls, and so on, but they decide the fate of kings and consuls. The Duke of York, father of Richard III, had ambitions to the throne. He incites Jack Cade, the rebel,
to make commotion, as full well he can. By this I shall perceive the common's mind, how they affect the house and claim of York.
How the commons think about claims to the throne matters. Back to the tragedy of King Richard III. After murdering Catesby, without the pretense of a trial, a dubious mayor of London on Richard's erding agrees to
acquaint our duteous citizens with all your just proceedings in this case.
In order to wrench the crown from King Edward, Richard of Gloucester has to prove better title by birth. He sends Buckingham to make the case before the people at the Guildhall. On his return, an anxious Richard is impatient to know the outcome. Richard.
How now, what say the citizens?
Buckingham.
Now, by the Holy Mother of our Lord, the citizens are mum. Say not a word.
Richard.
Touched you the bastardy of Edward's children?
Buckingham did. He repeats the details of his speech to Richard and concludes,
and when mine oratory grew toward end, I bid them that did love their country's good cry, God save Richard, England's royal king.
Richard.
And did they say?
The reply,
no, so God help me, they spake not a word, but like dumb statuas or breathing stones, stared each on other and looked deadly pale.
The good citizens are no longer quite so good. Richard.
What tongueless blocks were they? Would they not speak?
The reply.
No, by my troth, my lord.
Richard cannot become king without the acclamation of the commons, no matter how strong his hereditary claim. A new image of the body politic begins to emerge. Far from being the feet, the people now occupy more noble organs. It is more than a matter of the king depending on them, as he depends on the feet. It is more than needing their acclamation on appointment, though that he needs. The people have an added role and responsibility. The common weal is their weal. It is to them the king and his counsellors must account. The people are, in short, the keepers of the common weal. They do not govern, do not want to govern. Perhaps do not have the ability to govern, but they want good government. They know the difference between good and bad government. They know when government is corrupt or incompetent, when councillors and officials are acting for self-interest rather than the common interest. The Earl of Warwick wins their greatest favour for his
deeds, plainness, and housekeeping.
When the Duke of Gloucester, as protector, a man respected by the common people, is wrongly accused of violating the common weal and murdered,
the commons, like an angry hive of bees that want their leader, scatter up and down and care not who they sting in his revenge. Myself have calmed their spleenful mutiny until they hear the order of his death.
In place of kings and officials ruling over the people, superiors commanding inferiors, government takes on a different hue. It is now an instrument, a means, for realizing the common good. It is constructed to do a job, perform a set of tasks, not to detach itself from its social foundations and become a separate source of power. Such tendencies are inevitable. Distinctions of wealth and power unavoidable. Some are more suited to government than others. To preserve the common good means to curb those natural tendencies. Government is the servant of the common good and the common people, not their master. To govern well, it must govern under the gaze of the people. Note those words, the gaze of the people. They hold within them a whole constitutional world. The disgraced Duchess Eleanor, Gloucester's wife, on being paraded through the streets of London in humble weeds before distant confinement, laments to her husband,
look how they gaze. See how the giddy multitude do point and nod their heads and throw their eyes on thee. Ah, Gloucester, hide thee from their hateful looks.
to Eleanor, trapped in the upper register, they are the giddy multitude. The view from the lower register is different. The common people are there, all around, always watching. They are not a giddy multitude, or fickle observers of the follies of nobles. They are instead the keepers of the common weal. That is their constitutional role and duty, their watchful gaze, the means of discharge. The nobles naturally resist, for power and privilege is at stake. They cast the commons as rude, unpolished hinds, illiterate townsmen to be flattered, angry bees who care not who they sting. That the realm is theirs, the nobles, to rule, its patrimony their birthright, they have no doubt. They define the common good to suit themselves. While any deeper sense is treasonous, the commons who defend it, dangerous. To that view, we now have an alternative, a new vision of the body politic where complaints and grievances take on new meaning. They are to be seen within the contours of the common good. The timely relief of grievances, whether against lords or government, is an essential element of the common good. The more political grievances, far from being a threat to harmony and order, are signs of malaise in the conduct of government, and so harmful to the common good. The people accept, perhaps grudgingly, that government is best conducted by others, the upper reaches of society. But they must be watched for corruption, incompetence. That the king has not appointed able advisers is a common complaint, while the temptation of corruption is ever present. Ceding authority to the few does not diminish the role of the people as keepers of the common weal. Others may perform the functions of government, but they answer to the people. And answer they must, for in the people lies raw power. Salisbury to King Henry.
Dread Lord, the commons send you word by me. Unless Lord Suffolk straight be done to death or banished from fair England's territories, they will by violence tear him from your palace and torture him with grievous death.
To the refrain of they say, Salisbury recounts the charges of the commons against the misdeeds of Suffolk, for which the king asks Salisbury to thank them for their tender, loving care. Locked in the lens of the upper register, Suffolk can only show surprise that rude, unpolished hinds should send such a message to their sovereign. Lord, in Suffolk's eyes, Lord Salisbury, one of the great peers of the realm, is below contempt, for...
You, my lord, were glad to be employed to show how quaint an orator you are. But all the honour of Salisbury hath won is that he was the Lord Ambassador, sent from a sort of tinkers to the king.
The king, a pious but weak man, pious enough for his wife, Queen Margaret, to propose he be Pope and have set the triple crown on his head, would have known what sort of tinkers were the people on whose behalf he reigned, and whose unpolished judgment contains a compelling reality, compelling as the conscience of the common good and as the wielders of raw power. Against that, the pretensions of the grandees, the creators of the upper register, to a reflective king, as Henry was, must have rung hollow. What is the common weal, of which the people are the keepers? Is it an abstraction open to any meaning? Is it the fickle whim of the giddy multitude? Does it have bottom, as Bottom asked of his dream-like experience with the Fairy Queen? The answer is the common good has settled meaning. It is a well-developed notion, and the people, the common people, have a true sense of it. What is the commonwealth that is being gelded and made an eunuch? The real Jack Cade and his Kentish band produced two bills of articles in reply to King Henry's request to know their cause. The common weal, according to the articles, is being destroyed by evil counsellors to the king and by oppression and misgovernment. The king is not to blame, for he is prevented from reigning like a royal king by the corruption of those around him. Mean persons have replaced the king's natural noble counsellors. They run the Privy Council and act behind the king's back. The common people bear the brunt. They are arrested and imprisoned without trial by law. They are daily subjected to extortion and oppression. they dare not take action to protect the title of their lands in the face of seizure by the king's menial servants. The sheriff and his men, especially the tax collectors, the belly, are repressive and extort more tax than is due. Election of the knights of the realm is corrupt, with the great landowners imposing their men in place of those selected by the people. The articles of the rebels are compelling because they draw on a foundation of constitutional understandings. Each person, regardless of rank, is entitled to the protection of rights and liberties through law. The common good consists in preserving the goods of the realm for the good of all and respecting the juridical worth of each person in its distribution. That is the bedrock of Western constitutionalism. It need not be like that. Not all societies are organized in this way. To grasp its significance, we would need to delve deeper into the social foundations of constitutional orders, into what Giambattista Vico called the natural law of nations. Each nation learns over time its natural law. This is a natural law in a social sense. It means the structure of social relations that each nation settles on according to need and utility. From the natural law of a nation comes a constitutional order to serve need and utility, which are grounded in the social relations. Ours is the legacy of the Roman Republic, where the foundational social relationship is civic equality. Not material equality, but equality in a constitutional, juridical sense. This sense of equality, I suggest, is the bedrock of constitutional thought from which we derive rights, liberties, and law. This sense of equality lies behind and makes compelling the complaints and grievances of the commons. Equality in this sense is the guiding principle of the lower register of constitutional thought. Let me illustrate the idea with one final episode from the colorful saga of Jack Cade. As Jack's star rises, his swagger swells. He sets out his program.
7 halfpenny loaves will be sold for a penny. The 3-hooped pot shall have 10 hoops, and it will be a felon to drink small beer. All the realm shall be in common.
The butcher interrupts with something more urgent.
The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers.
Jack agrees. Jack agrees and explains why.
Nay, that I mean to do. Is this not a lamentable thing, that the skin of an innocent lamb should be made parchment? That parchment, being scribbled o'er, should undo a man? Some say the bee stings, but I say 'tis the bee's wax. For I did but seal once to a thing, and I was never my own man since.
Books are condemned and the clerk hanged for being able to write his name. Lord Say is berated for erecting a grammar school. Speaking French is treason. Is this evidence that the commons are, after all, ignorant, intolerant, and bloodthirsty? The mob. That's how it appears from the upper register. But there is another explanation. Schools, writing, and printing are used as instruments of oppression of the commons. The man who cannot read is unable to answer charges levelled against him. They are often in French, which he does not understand. Latin, the other language of law, hides from the common man knowledge of his birthright. Keeping the people in ignorance is a weapon against the weak. Jack Cade and his trusty assistant, the butcher, are murderous villains. In a fashion familiar in populist movement, Jack Cade becomes ambitious. He will apparel all his brother citizens in livery, and in this livery will worship me, their lord. As his ambitions in their awfulness become clear, his followers melt away, leaving Cade to his fate. But again, beware that character, not cloud, cause. Cade becomes a distraction from the common's profound understanding of the common weal, at whose core is a notion of equality and respect that goes with it. Do we then find an answer to Hume's question hidden in the undergrowth of Shakespeare's plays? Is there evidence of a lower register of constitutional thought, a register anchored in social reality and effective in procuring good government? There seems to be some evidence that there surely is. The people accept authority, they They acknowledge the iron law of society by which the few will always govern, but they insist on being governed well, by having the power to decide who governs, the means to scrutinize government, and the final power to be rid of governors. The people are truly the keepers of the common good. They are realists. They know that the common good will never be fully achieved, that certain basic social goods, protection, respect, and the means to live in a tolerable life are all they can expect. They know that authority leads to giddy ambition, that the haughty and proud will do all they can to increase their authority, enrich themselves, and create a world separate from that of the people. They know that authority will be dressed in fine concepts, sovereignty, representation, and consent, adorned with symbols of majesty and pomp. Despite all that, by keeping them under constant gaze, by stinging when stinging is needed, they know the few can be contained and controlled. For these reasons, complicated, subtle, misunderstood, the people put aside raw power and acquiesce in a less than perfect social order. That is the mystery of things, through which Lear saw and in seeing drove himself mad. But there is, as we saw, no getting off the stage. Lear and Cordelia at least learn it is a stage. Revelation leads to resignation. Knowledge enables detachment. The wry eye, as if of an audience, even if for them the stage has become a prison. Just as for Hamlet, the world is both a stage and a prison of the mind.
For there is nothing, either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. To me it is a prison.
Lear and Cordelia are reconciled, but they do not know that the iron law of tragedy has one last terrible toll to exact. For a brief moment in that reconciliation, Lear's resignation is complete. It is wise resignation, a detached, almost amused resignation to the mystery of things. Let Lear, addressing Cordelia, have the last word.
Let's away to prison. We two alone shall sing like birds in a cage. When thou dost ask me blessing, I'll kneel down and ask of thee forgiveness. So we'll live and pray and sing and tell old tales and laugh at gilded butterflies and hear poor rogues talk of court news. And we'll talk with them too, who loses and who wins, who's in, who's out, and take upon us the mystery of things as if we were God's spies. And we'll wear out in a walled prison, packs and sects of great ones that ebb and flow by the moon.